folks, this is Rocco Sisto. He's famous stage, screen, walking down the street.
Shoveling snow.
Yeah, shoveling snow too. He's a wonderful actor. He's been, and we'll go through his career in a few minutes. But he lives around the corner now. He lives in New York too. But when he needs sanity, he comes here. Because there's a lot of, but we've developed a friendship for many years now, and we even did work during COVID when nobody was working. These little independent thing, And Rocco is, you obviously know he's Italian, and he starred in Sopranos.
Yes, Uncle Junior as a young man.
Uncle Junior as a young man. And, God, your experience in Shakespeare and Company and Barrington Stage and all, it's, you're a gifted person.
Oh, well, thank you.
No, I mean, the roles you played. I mean, think about the roles you played.
Well, it's very interesting you say that, because someone just sent me on Instagram a clip from my debut, cinematic debut, playing a mad, evil, a shyster, Lacey Bowles, who and the clip they showed was me holding a teenager as her mother is thrown down a set of steps, and I thought, what an auspicious start to a cinematic. All that Shakespeare Chekhov I'd studied, and
I am
playing some inbred crazy man, and trying to. But it was a film. They're directed by Michael Winner, whose claim to fame. He was a very interesting man. His claim to fame is that he directed all the Death Wish films.
Oh,
yeah, he was an Englishman.
As
he was so affected, he couldn't even pronounce my name. He said, "Wacko, oh Wacko." So English.
Yeah, I was assigned to the UK for a while, and they still think we're the colonialists.
Well, yeah, well, maybe they're right. Who knows?
I developed my Cockney accent, so when I went to a pub, I could speak like them.
Oh,
American. Once they heard the English, they said, "Oh, you're an American."
Oh, you're yank.
Oh, God.
Yeah, no, but, it's all right. Well,
The theater. You think is it? I know there's a lot of old stuff coming back.
You mean, what do you mean, theater here or in New York?
In the city and here generally.
Well, there's a lot of theater being made. I'm sort of terrified that the price is going to keep people who should be seeing it out of it.
Yes.
And I know that I'm a liberal, right? I'm a liberal guy. And they've started this ridiculous, what is it, a poll tax? $9 every time you cross the 60th Street in Manhattan, congestion pricing. And I'm thinking, okay, so that's another $9. And then and people are spending $200 per ticket to see a Broadway show.
Then you have to
pay for parking. And then you have to, if you buy a dinner, $1,000, close to $1,000 to go to see a 3-hour play? That's ridiculous. Stupid. Because no one then can afford it.
That's exactly, they priced them. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
And God forbid you want to go and stay overnight.
Oh, well, that's another.
I mean, you got to sell the kids.
Yeah, or rent them out.
Or rent them out. That's kind of a fear that I have, too. And I noticed that the attendance has been good. I went down to Shakespeare to see, I think it's 7 Tall Persian Women, it was an amazing show.
Oh, good.
It showed you the decide that the news doesn't show you the people of Iran.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And
which is what theater should do. Theater should open you up to new ideas and, you know, try to, you know, it's to expand. It's to, well, I you know, I always come back to this, and I must have said it to you on a few occasions here, actually. But, you know, the translation of theater, the ancient Greek, means to behold God with wonder.
Wow. Yes,
now,
we have. Thanks for bringing that back up.
What?
Thank you for repeating that. Yes, you have. But with my memory, I don't know where the car is.
But so. Yes, but that's the thing. People go, you know, for Kristen Linkletter, who is another wonderful, wonderful woman who helped start the show, was a founding one of the founders of Shakespeare and Company, said that, you know, the work of the actor in ancient Greece was to literally to add to the harmony of the spheres.
Wow.
So that, and the way the theaters were built was to allow God to hear you as well as the audience.
Yeah.
So that, and think of, you know, everyone's talking about, what's my motivation? What's my motivation? What is your motivation? To keep the universe together. That's kind of amazing. Because if you don't, you add to the discord. And you know, I know it's flouncy and, you know, pseudo philosophical, but, you know, that's what we do, you know. And somebody said I worked, there were some terrible things being said on social media, and someone accused me of being a propagandist. You're a propagandist. Look at your business. And I'm thinking, well, maybe I am, but I'm good. You know, there's good trouble, and that's the trouble I want to do. Even, you know, playing creeps and playing, you know, it's like I'm showing the other side. I'm showing what, and if we follow that, then we get something out of it, and it's you know, it's a good, it's noble that way. I can see myself doing some noble stuff, and adding to, you know, adding to the. To the harmony of the spheres, you know. Anyway, that's enough of
no. I and when I go, the best thing that ever happened to me was when I was a young kiddo. I went to see Man of La Mancha and Never on Sunday on Broadway.
Oh,
right, and I really fell in love with live theater. It was just something about being next to the people in the stage. I mean, I like films too, but as I say on the show, if I said it once, I said it 7,000 times. I don't care if you see the same play four times in a row, it won't be the same play.
Nope.
Every performance is unique.
Yep.
You know, and I hope they don't one price themselves out of existence.
Well, yeah, I do too. I mean, you know, Off Broadway came about because of that. Because
that's right.
And because the work wasn't being done, and it was people, you know, there wasn't transparency of views, and so that's where Off Broadway. And now even Off Broadway has become can be prohibitively expensive. You know, and so I'm worried, you know, and
yeah, I don't blame you. And I think up here these folks are struggling to keep the prices in
down.
Line. I really
sure. Well, you know, there's the amount of theater up here is stupendous, and that might be a problem too, because if the overhead for that many seats is that many people, and there's, you know, there's you only have so many people to see these plays, you know. So people are choosing. What are they going to see? If they are they going to see something experimental? Are they going to see a modern? Are they going to see a modern or a classic? And then it comes down to price, you know. I mean, there have to be at least half a dozen professional theaters up here within a 15-minute drive. I mean, you know, you have Shake and Co. and Berkshire and Barrington and Chester,
Williamstown.
Williamstown. That's five right there, you know.
Yeah.
Then what in New Hampshire? There's I mean less than
New Lebanon over there on New
yeah.
Lebanon.
Yeah, New Lebanon,
Yeah.
and Chatham, you know, there's
Adam.
stuff going on.
Yeah.
So yeah, so who knows? Maybe I know it's a center for theater. I just hope it stays that way. That's all.
Yeah, I'm with you, and I can see what I say to the public is we have to support it. And if
Yeah.
the other thing that I think we have here, and maybe not as much, we have a lot of plays underwritten by very generous people,
Yes.
you know, and
Yes.
I applaud those people. Please don't stop doing it, because that is also a breath of fresh air in the theater.
Well, yeah, no, I just came out of a reading of a Tennessee Williams play that is hardly ever done. And I read it in college and I couldn't get through it. And it was one of those plays. It's a Camino Real or Camino Real. Tennessee wants it pronounced both ways at different points in the play. And it was one of these 29-hour readings by the union, that's stamped by the union. So you go in there and you rehearse. Over
Yeah.
the week, you rehearse for a total of 29 hours. And then you do the play. You do one reading of the play. And I walked in, and there were over two dozen actors.
Wow.
Because that's how many characters there were in the play.
Okay.
And I thought, oh, this is an old style play, you know, because there we are with all of
yeah.
these different actors, and some big parts, some small parts, and there were 24 actors. And I thought, well, and speaking about someone with deep pockets, there was a man who, because it was professional, and we got paid, and I was amazed. There we are, because it was a luxury to work. And of course, then I, after, you know, 50 years coming back to this play, I thought, oh, now I know what this play is about.
Yeah.
Know, now I understand. Back then I didn't understand it, but that play couldn't be done. It's hardly ever done. And this man wants to do it off Broadway. And I'm like, please God, let nothing happen to this man.
Yeah, please, yeah.
Between now, or maybe let's hope that he puts in his will, because he's fabulously wealthier from what I understand. He's very wealthy. And I thought, and for him to want to do this play, I mean, first of all, it's an old chestnut. No one knows about it. It was Tennessee Williams. It was an abject failure. Ilya Kazan directed it. I think it was written in 1953, and Tennessee Williams was doing something experimental. So he broke the fourth wall, which meant that actors were talking to the audience, and even some actors go into the, there's characters that, and you think, is there a plot? Isn't there a plot? And then you realize, that's right. He was being influenced by Samuel Beckett. He was being influenced by Bertolt Brecht. And here was Tennessee Williams doing that. He was smacked down. I mean, it closed before it opened, I think. But and it's always been in his collective works, and people have studied it, and they love it. But it's a difficult play. And it takes someone with heart to do that. Joe Papp would do that as a producer. Joe Papp took artists and directors and gave them work. He gave actors work. Raul Julia is a perfect example. You know, here's this. James Earl Jones is another example. There's Raul. You know, guys that Martin Sheen played Hamlet with a Spanish accent, by the way. And there was James Earl Jones, a 42-year-old Lear, You should see it. It's on PBS. You can look it up. It's fabulous.
Okay.
He was, and even if it was, I was in a production where he and he directed it of Hamlet with a woman playing Hamlet, Diane Venora. I must say, that's the best Hamlet I've ever heard and seen.
Wow.
She was spectacular,
Wow.
and so, and there was. You know, interracial casting and intersexual casting. And that was Joe. And he was
Yeah.
doing that in 1968. You know,
Yeah.
he employed Olympia Dukakis, who you and I know,
Yeah.
you know, and got her work. And so when you have producers like that who aren't afraid to go out on a limb, and he, you know, and of course he did have shows that made money. Chorus Line is one, and you know, Edwin Drood is
Yeah.
another, and you know he had the moneymakers that, and even those were experimental to begin with. No one thought that a musical by unknown people about
Right.
a Chorus Line would actually work, and here it is. You know, 30 years, 40 years later, whatever it is,
Yeah.
still making money for the public theater. And so, or Hamilton, which the public has just.
Yeah.
You know, where they have someone that has an idea and doesn't is not afraid to produce it, you know. And if it's go and you know, he's had clunk. You know, Joe had clunkers. You know, and I've been
Yeah.
in them, but he always says it was a it's noble. It's funny, I just got a bunch of phone calls and emails because I was in the New York Times quite by accident because
Oh.
Richard Foreman passed away. Now, Richard Foreman was one of the madmen of theater. You know, he wrote, directed, did sound design, even stage manage, and did some voiceovers in his production, which are. They were wild. They were wild. They non-linear, or they may be linear. No one really knows. They were provocative, you know. But Joe hired those people, you know. He hired. I was doing one of 25 years ago. I was doing one of these productions that Richard Foreman was it directed, and. You know, a riot started
Wow.
in the audience because they were arguing. I thought, wow, what passion. This is art. No, it's not. This is art. No, it's not. You know, and they
Well.
started slapping each other. I'm like, oh my God, you know, this is in the theater. People are really pissed. I thought, well, this is great or it's not, but it's getting
Yeah.
something, you know, talking. And so Joe was a provocateur that way. And
Yeah.
he didn't mind losing money if it was a good fight, you know. He had hired people that didn't have the point of view that everyone had, and didn't have the popular point of view, and took chances, like you know, theater artists like Joanne Acolytis and Richard Foreman, and so I think that's what we, you know, we need those people, you know, and
The only
I don't.
part that's scary to me, and I agree, you need people to push the boundaries. And like you said, which I don't think a lot of people realize, that the rule of thumb was the actors acted with each other. They didn't involve the audience. And when that started, that was like, whoa, time out, you know? And now it's done all the time.
Yeah, no, well, you know,
Because you're old enough to remember when it started happening and know the history of it. But if there's people today, if you say, 30 years ago the actors couldn't talk to the audience, they say, oh, please, you're making that up.
well, they didn't, you know, it was, you know, the fourth wall, as they call it, you know, and
Yes.
when they started breaking the fourth wall, but Shakespeare did it too, you know, with his asides. You know, and Shakespeare would and interest and some of the characters I played one at the Public Theater actually. What Autolycus in The Winter's Tale is a thief, and as he sings, he dances, he steals. And the director, who shall go nameless, on the very first day of rehearsal, said, you know, I really hate it when the actors talk to the audience. My eyes lit up. I was like, oh, wow, okay. And so I went to the dramaturg and I said, you know, the only character, because the audience is a character. I said, you know, the only character I actually tell the truth to in this play is the audience. I'm talking right to the audience. I don't talk, right, you know, he says, you know, my name, he's alone on the stage and he goes, my name is this and I do that and this is what I do. And Hamlet says that all, you know, he's talking to the audience. And so, you know, there is a history of that. And so with this director, I, you know, did all of my speeches, you know, to God, to the ceiling, to the floor, to my, and finally he said, no, all right, you can talk to the audience. And I thought, oh my God, thank you. No, now I can do my job. Now I can work on my craft.
What a visionary.
Wow. Isn't that great? But then, you know, there are some, you know, who am I? You know, there are some that push me and they leave me with a sour taste in my mouth. You know, I think, oh, I don't like what you do. You know, Peter Handke, who was a German, he might have been Swiss, H-A-N-D-K-E, Handke, Peter Handke, wrote these very, and in the 50s and the 60s, post-war Germany. And it was all very, he pushed the envelope,
yeah,
you know, and one of the plays he wrote was Offending the Audience. That was the name of the play. And it was, and it might have been because, you know, the German theater was so overproduced, yeah, and there was so much money that they said, oh, the hell with it. Let's just get them out of here. But the object of the play was to get the audience so upset that they would leave. And they did.
You know, geez.
But I thought, okay, well, that experiment went. Unfortunately, he should have written a play, you know, getting the audience back into the theater, yeah, you know. He didn't. But, you know, and that's theater. You know, those guys are always, there are directors that I just, they do stuff and my teeth hurt. I'm so upset by them.
Yeah.
But that's my taste. And so, and we all have to decide. But we have to be allowed to decide, you know. When it becomes rarefied, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
I think your experiential level is spanned years, but it's also spanned all the mixes, the you know, film, stage, and what I'm seeing now, I've told this story before. I wouldn't have gone to see Shakespeare and Company with a gun to my head, because I remember it from high school. And it was tedious, and God, I'm never going to get through this. Well, then a wonderful lady, good friend, educator, former chairperson of the school committee, Kathy Ann, said, Bill, Shakespeare was never meant to be read. It was meant to be acted. So I went down there, Shakespeare and Company, and before I left, a friend of mine who's vision impaired said, I want, close your eyes during this and just listen, because he's a big fan. And so I went down and I did that. And I have to tell you, I'm an addict now.
Well done.
Well, when it's done by professional, and even the kiddos, it's like a Taconic, you know, Shakespeare comes up and the kids perform a, it's an amazing thing. I mean,
yeah,
totally.
Because you own the language.
You close your eyes, and that's when it sings.
I'll tell you, I just came back from the Modern Language Association. Don't tell me where they, don't ask me where they are. Oh, and I went down to Louisiana, and I'm working on an adaptation of a play.
Okay.
And so I'm working on this edit, and they've invited me, and I did 15 minutes of it,
Oh, cool.
and there I am. I'm working on it, and I went to listen. There are literally hundreds of people who are presenters, right? Who present their ideas of language.
Right.
And so I thought, oh, great, let me go and listen to a couple. Well, it was like watching paint dry. They had written it all down, you know, the variants of spellings and Beckett and oh, you know, the use of punctuation and all. And I'm thinking, well, that's really terrible. This is
Yeah.
because I don't understand what you're saying, because they didn't know how to speak to an audience,
Yeah.
you know, and they had all this help, you know, they had microphones and lights and all this stuff, and they still didn't know how to do it. And I asked one of the people that have been going there and was a member of it, and I said, hey, listen, does anyone come to this language convention and actually talk about the spoken word? And his eyes was like, oh no.
There you
Oh
go, change
no,
the thing
that
around.
invites a whole different dynamic. I'm thinking, well, yeah, it does, doesn't it? It's a,
Yeah.
you know, and I can go and point out to you how Shakespeare would do that. And if you want to look at the folio, let's talk about his different uses of spelling words in order to emphasize words in a different order, and how, you know, but you have to, you can write about it, but if you don't hear it, you know, it doesn't make any sense. And I'm thinking,
And it's how you hear it.
yeah, it's
Is
how you,
somebody
and you have to be,
reading?
yeah, you have to.
Is it somebody saying, Romeo, 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 wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Well, you know what, you know, another thing that the Elizabethans did, and well into after them, and the Jacobeans
Yeah.
even farther, they went to hear a play.
Yeah.
They didn't go to see a play, they went to hear a play.
Right.
And
Yep.
you know, Shakespeare invented 1700, at least 1700 new words.
I
So
know.
they would go, oh, did you hear this word that he would say, you know, enchantingly? Oh, I never heard that said, you know. So I don't know, I don't know. I have faith because
It's an
young people are
evolving
changing
world.
language, you know. I have faith that the young
Yeah.
people have changed language, and you know, of the poetry, you know, they,
Yeah.
the street poetry is, that's what Hamilton did,
Yeah,
you know.
exactly.
You
We
know,
got to take a break. I'm here in case you don't recognize this guy. He's famous in on stage, film, radio, everywhere. He can't walk down, well, he can walk down these streets because only a few people know him. But this is Rocco Sisto, a longtime friend and a marvelous actor. And I enjoy having him on because he gives you the real meal deal behind the scenes. And before we run to this. When you said you went down to study this, when I ran the Violent Youthful Offender program, orientation, they couldn't use two words. And it was quiet as a pin. They couldn't use the F word and they couldn't say like. And it was
very
like
good.
they couldn't talk.
They're
We'll be
stuck.
right back. This is WTBR 89.7 FM on your radio dial, simulcasting on PCTV. We got big news going to break very soon. Very soon, we are growing. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR FM.
This is Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR FM Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
Missed an episode of your favorite show? Have no fear, because we have podcasts. Type in WTBRFM.com/podcast on your favorite browser and search for your favorite show. It's that simple.
We all know WTBR is great to listen to on 89.7 FM, but did you know that you can listen to WTBR just about anywhere? We've got a web stream, and it's easy to use. Go to WTBRFM.com on your computer and click play. You can use the TuneIn app on your smartphone and connect it to your car's sound system. Or you can use your smart speaker. Just say, Alexa, play WTBRFM, and there's your community radio station. WTBR, for the love of radio.
Some news outlets tell you what to believe, and they limit your access to the whole story. Some of them are just plain ugly and mean. Social media is filled with rumors, misinformation, personal attacks. Where locally can you get the whole story, unfiltered, so that you can make informed decisions at the ballot box? There's really only one place. It's on PCTV. On cable, on the PCTV Select app, and at PittsfieldTV.org. The whole story since 1986. PCTV. See it all and decide for yourself.
Join us for Up on Taconic, a weekly show that explores the world of Taconic High School from students, staff, school programs, and all of the great things that happen here each day. Explore the world with conversations including the culinary arts and other CTE programs. Hear students and teachers discuss the importance of reading and also take a look at the vibrant arts culture in the school and much, much more. Join us every Monday at 6 p.m. for these lively discussions right here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. BCC provides access to higher education to everyone in Berkshire County and beyond, offering more than 50 high-quality programs, small class sizes, and an affordable education to help their students of all ages achieve their dreams. At BCC, their middle name is Community. And UCP of Western Mass. Turn passion into purpose when you apply at UCP of Western Mass, now offering full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. It's more than just a job, it's our identity. Apply today at ucpwma.org/jobs.
Radio for people who used to love radio. Welcome back, WTBR.
And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
We are back. The good-looking guy you see there, he's Rocco Sisto. He's a famous movie star, Broadway plays. Up here, he's Shakespeare and Company. You were one of the founding people, or one of the original Shakespeare.
I didn't count myself that until Tina Packard said I was, and then I went, okay, all right. So if you say I am, then I am.
And I will tell you, I always, and why I have Rocco on, he's the real meal deal. There's no phoniness about him. And we talk about the theater, and I have him on. We were on a few times during COVID. And just listening to how the actors and the all the people associated with movie productions, TV productions, and the theater, they were suffering.
Oh, God. And we're suffering still.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we were on strike last year, and we got some concessions, and it seemed to be working, but the industry hasn't bounced back. You know, there's this very odd thing that there's less work, but there's more work. I don't know what the deal is, but there's less professional work, and there's a lot of streaming. And and now with the fires in L.A., just amazing. I mean, you know, production was down, I think, 40%, 30-40%.
Wow.
And over the last couple of years, because people are not watching television, they're streaming, and stuff isn't being done just in Hollywood anymore. So we've learned from cities like Detroit, which was a one horse town, that Pittsfield after GE left. that when the single employer leaves, the city goes into real shock. And like Detroit or Pittsfield or Hudson Falls, you know, same thing happened. And so we're it's kind of frightening what's happening there, because it's going to take a while for it to get rebuilt. And I think they have to rethink, because it's cheaper now to go to places like Georgia, North Carolina, New Zealand, Canada, South Africa, Australia. You know, they're going to go there, and if they and so I think it's going to be a tough. I don't have an answer for it. I don't know
The future is certainly ambiguous. I have this thought, and I'll share it with you, and you may appreciate it. We have the largest manufacturing freestanding building, I think, in the world.
What, in Pittsfield?
Yeah. GE built it. Sabic took it over. What a wonderful, magnificent soundstage that would be.
Oh, my God, yeah.
No beams, high ceiling, all the stuff you need. And it sits there. I don't know who owns it anymore or anything else, but every time I drive by that, I think, what a magnificent soundstage that would be. And my wife said, if you said that one more time, I'm walking.
That'd be great.
It's a retooling. Don't you think COVID is causing all of us to retool?
Yeah, I agree. Well, you know, De Niro's just built another new studio, speaking of studios, in Brooklyn.
Oh, wow.
You know, there's Silver Cup, which is already there. And there's the Navy Pier, which is there and being built. But there are a couple of new studios being built there. And there are old warehouses that have been, taken over. But, so... Hopefully,
but look at the people who come here from that career field for the summer or ski or whatever.
Oh, God, yeah.
Imagine if you had a production studio here, they would flock to the Berkshires.
Yeah, that's true. It's true.
You know,
well, there is film. There's a lot of film being done up here, too.
Oh, yes, there is. You know, yeah.
Lots of film. I've done a couple up here, and a good friend of mine, Deborah Sims, is associate producer, I believe, and Elizabeth Aspen, leader of Shakespeare.
Was on, I don't know, 30 or 40 years at Shakespeare. She just celebrated like an anniversary.
Yeah, she came and never left.
I gotta reach out to her again. She's a sweetheart.
She's helping with making film happen up here. You know, and I'm always like, hey, anybody need a tall Italian?
Yeah. I can play a priest or a gangster, whatever you need.
Whatever you want. I'll talk with an accent.
Yeah. It's like my cousins in Boston used to say, my uncle and aunt, the firstborn is a priest. The secondborn is a cop. The thirdborn is a politician. You think back, this really is a transitional time and period. Not only for theater, but for all of us.
All of us, yeah. Yeah, very much so. I think...
on AI. If I were an actor, even now, I write books and articles and stuff, but I'm worried.
Well, that's what the strike was about. You know?
I know.
And it's gotten more perfected. It's getting very, very, very difficult to see what to disretain who, or we've had it written into the contract that they can't put an AI character in that can be played by a real live actor, you know? So that's part of the contract, because it's getting easy. You just, you know, plug it in and you got it. And now with, I think James Earl Jones, before he died, whoever it was, not Spielberg, what's his name, from the movies, the you know the films,
Scorsese.
Yeah, Darth Vader, that they could use his body of work, his voice on tape, or that's been retrieved, that they can rejigger it to another character, another performance. So, but he's allowed that, you know, at least, you know, because that character has a history. But it's easy to invent, and people are. And I don't know if you heard about the scam where you get a phone call from, you know, you're like your daughter, your son, your grandmother. Oh, please send me $100. They won't let me out. And then you find out that they've actually just taken the voice and
they manipulated it.
And there you are. So
well, the big thing now we're getting is this. I think one of the first people to put it up is the scam from FastPass. Thing that reads your when you're on the turnpike.
Oh yeah,
that you had a bill of $6.99, and if you didn't pay it, there would be interest. Well, now they've even sweetened it a more, to cause a bad term, that if you don't pay it, sign up and pay it forthwith, you'll lose your license.
Oh hello,
it's a scam.
Well, that's what they're doing with this congestion pricing. They set up all these cameras on 60th Street. Yep. A friend of mine just asked me, he said, how do they collect it? I said, they scan your license plate.
Yeah.
You know? And now there's things about guys that are, or people that are like fixing their license plates that they can't be read by that.
Right.
Well, anyway, for me, it's a boondoggle, if it's a good, you know, a good word. That's because they keep on saying, oh, we're doing it for mass transit. And I'm like, you're not doing it for mass transit. No. It's like, I'm old enough to remember that the Second Avenue subway was supposed to go from 125th Street down to Houston, and it didn't. They only got part of it built, and that cost, you know, how many billions of dollars, and it's still not done. They're never... And, you know, and that's the part of me that is just like, no, when they use that word administrative costs, I go, no.
Now, overhead.
Overhead.
Yeah.
Overhead what?
Yeah. You are over your head.
You are over your head.
But what do you got in the hopper? Anything?
I have this piece I'm working on, which is kind of like driving me nuts. And, you know, I'm at that point now that... because of COVID now, the industry's changed. And so you're doing a lot of self-taping. So you self-tape auditions, which is not what I like. I'm not one of those people.
Losing a lot of flavor to me. I mean.
Very much so. And so I have to deal with that. And so, it's funny. I had an audition for a commercial a couple of weeks ago. A week ago, Thursday. Please, you have to have it in. And so, you know, you have to get the camera and you got to do the lights and you do it. And then but the callbacks will be in person. I thought, okay, well, I got a callback. And I actually go to this office on 29th Street. And I walk into a tiny little room. And there's just somebody there holding a camera. And then I thought this was a callback. And then they went, oh, hello. And I hear this disembodied voice. It was a callback, but the people that were calling me back were in another city. I thought, oh, I'm never going to meet you guys, right?
It was Oh, wow.
So there it is. You know, it's like Twilight Zone. You walk into rooms, you don't know who you're going to meet.
That's exactly, you know, thinking back on the old Twilight Zones, they're reality now.
Oh, God, yeah. I remember the first time I saw Twilight Zone where somebody was walking and he said something and the typewriter wrote it.
Yeah.
You know, he was actually voice texting. And I remember being a kid. I thought, oh, that'll be incredible if that ever happened.
Yeah.
And here I am using that technology. And now my wife just told me that there's automatic translation into different languages. So you put something in your ear, someone speaks to you, and it's translated automatically. I thought, whoa.
Yeah, it's right on your phone.
Yeah.
Translator.
Speaking of AI, they have now AI so that they can manipulate your voice.
Yeah.
So to give, and the performance in your lips, so that you will speak in a different language. So if this is performance is being done in French, all of a sudden you're speaking French.
Wow.
And I thought, well, that's great. Now I don't have to study French.
That would not make my French teacher happy.
Nope. Or my German teacher.
The other thing is, remember Dick Tracy talking?
Sure. Here we are.
We're here. Yeah. And I think for some of the younger people watching this, they're thinking, these two guys are goofy.
They're analog.
Yeah, that's it. I have to tell you this story. So I'm on this board, see, and the guy says, well, I don't use the telephone. I just use text. I'm a millennial. So I'm not quick with this stuff. And so I missed a couple of texts from him. So I saw him. He said, well, Bill, I told you I'm a millennial. I text. I said, well, I'm a baby boomer. I call. I mean,
if you call someone on the phone, they're offended.
Oh, they are. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you want? Who are you?
Yeah. And, you know, just to go back before we run out of time, I'm heartbroken about the fires in L.A. I'm heartbroken for your industry, but I'm heartbroken for the people who their whole life, I can't even imagine it. Everything's gone. Baby pictures, wedding. And I hope this gets resolved and not turned into a partisan bickering match.
Oh, God, yes. No, that's ridiculous. As far as, the Santa Ana winds are there.
Someone and
said,
they've been there.
And they've been
not
there
like they're new.
Years, you know, thousands of years. The thing about it is that, you know, that part, that's a desert. That's a desert. And when you start planting plants and you're in the dry season and you have winds, that it'll burn. And now, you go into Los Angeles and Southern California and you breathe this and, you know, you see all this perfume air, and one of them are eucalyptus trees. Well, they explode.
Yeah,
you know, it gets hot, and they catch on fire, and the whole tree will explode because of the oils in the resin, and because they shouldn't be growing there. You know, where do they come from? Africa, South Africa, Asia.
Yeah,
and so you have all of this stuff there that. You know, when they were orange groves, I suppose it was okay because they were just, now they're just, and now everything is built. You know, I was in Santa Clarita they talk about, you know, there shouldn't be, it's desert. There shouldn't be water there. And then I'm going by all these fountains. People are just, you know, I suppose it's all right. Well, it's not, you know, I don't know. It's going to be scary. I just hope that
we can
come back from it.
The Polish princess and I, we lived in Arizona, and they're finally in Tucson. They had to put their foot down because all these people were moving from the East Coast to Tucson to the desert because they had breathing issues. But they brought their trees and their grass with them, which caused the breathing issues.
So, yeah.
You know, it's like, folks,
well, one of these things, you know, you see a golf course in the middle of the desert. It's like, what are you doing?
Yeah, you know, exactly.
How much water do you use to water this thing? I mean, come on, it's a golf course. You know, there shouldn't be a green here, you know? Anyway, you know, but that's
my... I think too, Rocco, if you would, I love the story about Edith Horton's place in the ghost.
What about it? What do you mean?
You guys, Shakespeare was there for years.
Oh, yeah. No, we were there. Everyone would talk about Edith. I would live there between 4 and 6 months a year, every year. You know, and I would then go back down to New York and I do regional theater. But I would come up and I was working up there. We were doing a very you know, it was in April and, you know, the mud season. And I remember we worked very hard all day, and I went upstairs to my room, which was actually Edith Wharton's dressing room. It was next to her boudoir, but it was, you know, like 20 by 20. It was a gigantic room. And I'm laying in my bed. And everyone had talked about, oh, this happened to me and the ghost happened to me. And I'm thinking, you're high. Smoking. Yeah. Stop. You know, just no. And so anyway, I fell asleep, and it was a moonlit night. I remember that, and I woke up, and I thought that was very odd. And I sat up in bed because at that time in my life I was, you know, sound sleeper, and I sat up in bed, and I could see something that at the foot of my bed that I can only explain. Was like boiling clothes, like in a washing machine.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, well, this is a nice dream. And I sat up, and it became something. It became a shape. And I thought, well, this is really scary. And I thought, okay, well, it'll go away. Well, it didn't. It pushed me against the headboards. So I was sitting up, being pushed up against the headboard.
Yeah.
And the only thing I could do was slide. So I was supine, laying down, and it started laughing. And it was pushing me down and laughing and humming, like, And I got scared, and I was praying, and I fell asleep. I don't know if I passed out or fell asleep. And I would think, oh, that's a dream.
Right.
Except it happened again that same night. I woke up, the same thing happened, pushed me against the headboard. It was laughing at me, pushing me down. But this time it was, you know, how the birds here.
Yeah.
Completely, you know, just before dawn, they start screaming, you know, they do that.
Yeah.
Well, at that moment, all the birds started chirping, and at that moment it just lifted off of me, and it was about 6:30, quarter to seven. It was about, that's when it was starting to get light.
Yeah.
And I was getting up, and you know, we had to go and make the bed for, you know, we were communal and we were taking care of each other, and I was putting the room back in order. And there was a knock on the door, and Tim Sukavicius, who was a member of the company, was going to drive me. I didn't have a car. He was going to drive me to Lenox to take a bus. And he opened the door, and I looked at him, and he said, "You look like you just saw a ghost." And I did.
I did.
I did see a ghost. But that was the Edith Wharton. But a lot of people have. And
exactly what I was going to say is, after I heard that you were the first one I heard it from years ago, since then I've heard it from several people.
Yeah, yeah. It's happened to a few people. And that same scenario, I've heard, it liked screwing around with guys. It did that to guys. Women, it just terrorized. It would throw things. It would throw things against the wall and close, shut doors, and it would like do that stuff. And there would be like visions, and you'd see something in the mirror or something, and terrorize. But for the men, it was this very sort of, you know, you think you're so strong?
Yeah. I'm bigger than
Hamish
you.
Hamish Linkletter had the same. Hamish as a child, I knew Hamish as a baby, and the same, and it was in those two rooms because there were two mirror rooms. One was the dressing room on either side. One was for the boudoir, the other one's for the bedroom, I believe, on the second floor. And Hamish had the same. In fact, he asked me to recount my story, and he said the same thing happened to him.
Wow.
He may be writing something about it. I'm not sure.
Oh. Well, good.
Yeah.
Well, because it's certainly a tale to be captured. And with the number of people who have experienced it, they're not going to just miss you as being goofy.
Well, that's what I, because I did. for years, literally about 5 years. I kept thinking, oh, you're high, you know.
Yeah.
But then it happened to me.
It's so good to have you back on. It's been too long.
Thank you, Bill.
Well, 100 times I said, I got to get a hold of Rocco. And then finally, we saw you the other day with the dog, and I was going to come home and do it then, but, you know, my memory. So
I'm with you.
But you are a gifted, and I say this to people who are in the arts. I don't care whether you're paint, you know, artist, actor, singer. You're gifted, and I'm happy to be able to tell people about your gift.
Well, thank you.
No, really and truly, if you ever get an opportunity to see Rocco in a perform, I'll tell you, you'll see why he gets selected. He's really dynamite. And I don't say that because he's a friend. I say that I appreciate talent, you know, and I wish more people in this world would stop being so damn judgmental and appreciate what's happening.
We have to love each other. We have to esteem each other. That's what it is, you know. And,
you know, working quickly, working with these violent youthful offenders, I spent a lot of time with them, and listen to their backgrounds and how they got. And a lot of it was some people or some person snatched their self-worth.
Mm.
And once you do that to somebody, it's a long road back.
Oh, boy.
You know?
Oh, boy. Oh, don't you know it? Yeah, I know.
You know, I'm sure you know people.
Well, you know, a lot of
actors are beautiful people. They're the most resilient people I know. They go in, they go to a rehearsal.
Audition, you mean?
An audition. You walk in, you give it your best, and you never get the call.
Oh,
but
my Lord.
They'll keep going back.
Yeah. Yeah, Olympia told me that. Olympia was in her mid-40s, raising three kids, and was as broke as anybody else, working, teaching at NYU, doing little roles on soaps. And her husband, Louis Zorch, was a wonderful actor and had a great mellifluous voice and did voiceovers and they patched together a career and a life for themselves. And it wasn't until she got that role in that movie, Moonstruck, that things lessened, you know, they became easier. But she told me, she said, we were sending our kids to school on credit cards.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa. You know, and we're all struggling. It's not, you know, but it's not, you know, no one put a gun to my head and said, be an actor. It's what I want to do. It's my vocation. But
I'm glad you did, because you're very good at it.
Thank you,
folks. We got to run. I can't believe time's up. Rocco, I'll see you in the neighborhood.
On the street.
Yeah, on the street, in the hood. and to my, as I always do, and I know this upsets some of you, but when you get your own show, you don't have to do it. God bless. And today, try to lift somebody up. Don't put somebody down. Lift somebody up, and remember, we're all in this together. Try to help each other out.
Talk to them.
Rocco, you're the best.
You too, sir.